Welcome to Risk Rustlers, where we celebrate the extraordinary journeys of modern-day risk leaders who embrace the art of grustle, a powerful fusion of grind and hustle. Our podcast dives into the innovative strategies and bold decisions taken by these risk takers, shaping the future of cybersecurity and risk management. Join us as we explore their inspiring stories, insightful advice, and the cutting-edge technologies that define the alternative GRC landscape. Welcome everyone to another episode of Risk Rustlers. One of the reasons why we started Risk Rustlers, the podcast series, was essentially to make the whole profession of risk management sound less intimidating to people starting out. And Gary is a prime example of that, because Gary spent 15 years working as a developer, and he incidentally found his way into information security and risk management. So would love to understand from you, Gary, on what was your journey like? What landed you into security? What feelings did you go through, and what was it like?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, I spent 15 years writing code, moved into architecture, building, designing systems. Through that journey, 9/11 happened, and obviously we all know what happened then. But that impacted the travel industry immensely. And one of the things I got involved in was working, handing data off to the Department of Homeland Security for their watch list that they were building out to make sure that it could never happen again. And as part of that, obviously that data transfer needed to be done very, very securely. So I really started to get interested in how do we secure the data? How do we make sure the bad guys can't get hold of our data and make sure nothing bad can happen again? So started designing the system, security first, making sure that they were locked down, making sure only the right people had access to the right data. And the chief information security officer at the time was moving from the company TravelCorp over to Expedia. And he needed to build a team over there. And he asked me to go with him. And I'm like, no, I design systems. I'm not a security guy. Why would you want me there? And he explained that he had some very smart architects over there, really smart. But they really couldn't translate the concepts that the business could really understand what needed to be done. And he needed somebody who could do that translation. And he'd seen me at TravelCorp explaining to people who had no idea about technical systems, no idea about security, and convincing them that we needed to invest in the right areas and do it properly. So I made that jump. 2011, I moved from a place I'd been for 15 years.
What did you feel? I mean, did you feel nervous about it? How much of a learning curve was that when you made the transition?
It was a very difficult transition. I second-guessed it multiple times, nearly didn't go. You know, I'm not the principal security architect he wanted me to be. I was very nervous. I very much felt the imposter syndrome that people talk about. You know, it was a difficult decision for me and my family. Had a very stable career, a very stable job, and I was jumping into the unknown, moving from Colorado to Seattle. It was a big change. It was a big change. I was very, very nervous. When I got there, was even more nervous. The architects there were way more intelligent than me. It was like, whoa, you know, there was a lot to learn. I really had to jump in with both feet and do a lot of research, a lot of learning, and a lot of learning by osmosis. I was in meetings with these guys day in, day out, and I was doing my job, doing the translation, making sure people understood what was going on, what needed to be done. And I learned a lot from them. They were, like I said, they were incredibly smart.
So let me ask you this, Gary, if I may, right? So when you came into an unfamiliar territory where you've actually managed to do very well over the years, there were a bunch of things you could have, because all of it would have been very new and somewhat overwhelming, right? So how did you start? What were the first couple of things you picked up that, you know, where you started finding your feet, where you started finding comfort from? What were the first couple of problem statements that you really worked on very hard?
it's all about sort of understanding the basics. And I think we'll get to that a little bit later. Making sure that everybody around me understood the basics. And they were really easy to pick up, right? As we're talking about identity and access management, making sure that everybody knows what to do and when to do it. Who has access to what? What is role-based access control? How do we divide that so only the right people have access to the right data and the right systems at the right time? And that sort of thing, I picked up on those very basic concepts very early on. And then I was able to sort of reiterate them and put them into the context of the solutions that the people wanted to push out. And I think I began to feel better about myself when people would come and ask me the questions instead of going and asking the architects who are already there. So they were obviously felt comfortable with me and felt comfortable. I knew the area, even though
because they were talking the language that people understood, right? I mean, there was one end of, there was a very esoteric group of people who obviously were great security architects, but in terms of how that got communicated to the people who would actually do the bulk of the activities that would make the organization secure. There would be signal loss. It could be perceived as very esoteric. So acting as a bridge sort of helped you dumb things down enough for people to find them actionable, right?
Exactly. And I think one of the other important things I became comfortable with very early on was saying, let me check on that. And you've got to become comfortable with not making things up. So I realized very early on is like, don't get in deep water. Don't try to make things up because you will get lost very quickly. Just be comfortable with saying, let me check on that. And then I could go confer with my colleagues, come back and then have the conversations once I had really got to grips with what we needed to do.
Got it. And Gary, you brought up a very interesting point and all companies having to go back to the basics, right? And so let me just do a bit of a segue into that. So there is a deluge of security tools out there. There's new acronyms that have come up in the last few years. And people and companies are also waking up to the idea of being more secure, both because they're trying to meet a regulatory mandate or demand, and also because the customers are now becoming a lot savvier and demanding them to be more secure. But it sometimes becomes hard to really understand what is it that matters, because there is a deluge of security tools and CISOs and their teams are inundated with multiple pitches, right? So you mentioned a point around companies having to go back to the basics. What does that look like? Could you just talk a little bit more about that?
We really need to understand the risk in an organization. We really need to have the processes that follow up on that risk and make sure we're remediating the right things. I think often we will buy lots of tools and then we will get lots of findings and nobody will know what to do with all of those findings because they're all overwhelming, they're all critical. But what are the most critical things? I think getting back to the basics really means you've got to do the basics first. Are you encrypting all of the right data? If you're encrypting it, are you using the right algorithms or are you using already compromised algorithms? How are you protecting your encryption keys? There's no point encrypting the data if your encryption key is stored in an S3 bucket that everybody can get to. And we've seen those sort of things. We've seen those basic compromises. Where is your data? Do you know everywhere your data is? Do you know who has access to that data? I was talking earlier about role-based access control. It's really important to know who has access at what part of the lifecycle of that data. And also, are you getting rid of the data after you don't need it? Why do you have data out there that you're protecting that you no longer need? Why is that not encrypted in an offline archive if you maybe need it for some sort of compliance or regulatory reason? There's no point to have that online, on the internet, in a risky place. So they are some of the real basic things. And then another conversation I have quite often is just about the supply chain. You know, we're all worried about our vendors who we hand the data off to people all the time. How do we know they're protecting it? We're seeing all sorts of complex processes of people wanting to do site visits. We must go out to see all of our vendors. That's very expensive. is that really spending money in the right way? If I look back at some of the biggest vendor compromises that I've seen come across my table in the last year, most of them have been down to business email compromise, phishing, ransomware. A site visit is not going to stop somebody clicking on a link in an email, but making sure they have the right level of training around phishing and ransomware, making sure people understand what it means to click that link, making sure they know how to identify when they've got something fake coming in, is way more important than, you know, going and seeing that they've got a 10-foot wall around their data center with a moat and, you know, all that good stuff.
Got it. Makes sense. So, and when organizations are trying to sort of get back to the basics, where do they begin in terms of identifying what controls matter? Is it essentially looking at, let's say, a SOC 2 or an ISO 27001 or a NIST? I mean, because all frameworks ultimately converge. They're talking about similar set of controls as far as going back to the basics are concerned. So where essentially do they get started? What's the starting point really?
I mean, for me, when we're looking, especially when we're looking at our vendors, we'll look at the SOC 2 and we'll say, do you have a SOC 2 or ISO 27001? And then that hits a whole load of checklists. We don't have to go to that deeper level because we know they've got the basic things done. And then we can focus on the real areas and look at those data exchanges with us. We can look at things like the identity and making sure that we have single sign-on, making sure we've got multi-factor authentication in those areas where we really need it. We don't want to have local authentication. We want to make sure that we have control of the access and getting rid of that access when people leave the company.
Got it. So I'll throw a challenge at you, Gary, and this is going to make it interesting for our viewers too. So I let's say I'm an enterprise SaaS company. I have been doing north of say $200-300 million in ARR, and I suddenly have a security budget, an infosec budget that's let's say 2% of my revenue, right? What is the worst piece of advice you can give me? Your challenge is to give me really, really horrible advice, absolutely horrendous advice. What would you advise me to do? And I don't have a security program in place already. Right? So I'm just getting started.
My advice would be go out and talk to a lot of vendors and bring in, just listen to the vendors and bring in, you know, as many tools as you can. And let the vendors tell you where your problems are. I think that's the world we're in, though. I think if I come in the morning and my inbox is full of vendors telling me where my problems are, for me, that's not it. What I've really got to get back to is understanding, you know, the tools that I have, aggregating the problems that they're finding, bringing all of those problems into one aggregated list, and prioritizing it accordingly. So we know that the business are only going to remediate so many findings based on the resources that we have. So we've got to make sure they're focusing on fixing the right things first. And if a really high priority comes in, it goes to the top of the list. Are we okay with something dropping off the bottom of the list? Because we know they only have a finite number of resources to fix all of these. If we're not okay with something dropping off the bottom of the list, then we've all got to go back to the business and start talking about we need more resources to get all of this resolved. But it has to be one or the other. We either have to invest resources into remediating all the problems we're finding, or we have to be acceptable. We have to be able to accept the risk and say, this is all we can fix. And everything below the line, that's acceptable risk. Do we have the right mitigating controls in place to accept that risk? If we have application vulnerabilities, for instance, do we have a web application firewall in place that's mitigating those vulnerabilities in the time that it takes for the developers to fix those vulnerabilities that we're finding?
So if I understand correctly, what you're talking about is essentially a risk-first approach to establishing a tool landscape instead of, you know, deploying solutions looking for their problems. And that's a very interesting point, Gary. Now, one follow-up question that's sort of a natural follow-up, and I can see a lot of viewers having this question in their mind, is that attackers are moving very fast and they're fairly sophisticated. Attackers don't have to deal with bureaucracy. Attackers don't have they don't have to take approvals to carry out malicious activity. So when we're talking about going back to the basics, how do we strike a balance between, you know, having a very bare bones InfoSec program, control ecosystem in place? Is there a trade-off involved? Are we actually giving upon a certain degree of sophistication? Are we fighting without enough ammunition against attackers who become very smart and sophisticated? How do we strike that balance?
I think one of the things we know is attackers are lazy, and they want to get the easiest way into your network. So you've got to make sure that your security hygiene is very, very clean. And once you've done that, then get to those next levels of sophistication. But there's no point getting the latest, greatest AI system in that's looking at the wrong things. So you've got to be keenly looking at your security hygiene and making sure the basic things are done first, and then you can get to that next level. But you've got to make sure also you have that processes in place to manage all of those findings that are coming down. Again, no point spending millions of dollars on that ultra cool AI system that's going to find loads of things if it's not finding the right things for your business and you don't have the process to handle them. So there is a place for all of this technology that's really going to help us identify things, but it's no good unless you have that prioritization process, you understand the things it's finding, and you have the process to remediate those findings as well.
Got it. And one of the questions that we often get, Gary, is when you are actually getting a security budget approved by the board, and oftentimes this is even more relevant when companies are just starting on their journey around establishing security controls. What is the business case really built around? What is the nature of the conversation that is had? How do you sort of build a case around approving a security budget? Can you talk about some experiences you've had around, you know, having a bit of a back and forth around getting budgets approved for security? Because oftentimes it's seen as a cost center. Maybe with the new SEC rules, maybe with the urgency around SBOMs, for example, the process of investing in security is going to be a lot more fluid and spontaneous, but there's still going to be a bit of a friction. I mean, how much to allocate, how to monitor success, how to monitor ROI from that expenditure. So what are those conversations like, really? What is the business case built around?
You know, I think you really have to get away from security being a cost center. And security professionals need to be able to turn the conversation into how you're enabling the business. And you're not being that blocker. You're not being that gate. How can we build the security controls into the tools that the developers and engineers are using? How do we create that security easy button for them? And that's really where my focus is right now in the role that I have, is working with my teams and enabling them to create that easy button, not being that layer of overhead. And if we can demonstrate that we're enabling the business, we're reducing risk, then those conversations become much easier. We do have to understand the company and the board's level of risk acceptance. What do they deem is acceptable risk for the company? And then how do we mitigate that risk and bring it down to that level of acceptance? You know, I think every board would say, well, we can't have any breach. But they're only going to invest so much into the security program. So there's always a level of risk that you are accepting. And our jobs as security professionals are to make sure everybody is understanding that risk that is accepted, making sure they're comfortable with it. If they're not comfortable with it, understanding what investment is needed to reduce that risk.
Got it. Makes a lot of sense. And Gary, one last question. And this is something that's bothering a lot of our peers as well. You see several startups now using LLMs around their core application, either for building an internal use case or delivering a use case built as a wrapper on top of a known LLM, right? Now, and there are variants to this. Some companies are actually using LLMs that open source LLMs that they train internally. Some companies are using third-party APIs. So now, oftentimes, companies would hit a wall when they're trying to sell to a large enterprise because there are legitimate concerns around how around the security practices that these companies would follow, also around privacy. Like you could put in PHI or PII through your prompt into an LLM, which might inadvertently surface somewhere else. And when there is an inadvertent way to do that, attackers can find a deliberate way to do that as well through prompt injections, right? So when startups trying to sell to large enterprises, when startups are trying to sell LLM use cases to large enterprises, what are the 4 or 5 key controls that you would think would be super relevant that sort of from the baseline hygiene controls that would help them sell better to large enterprises?
I think that's a very interesting question, and it's very topical right now. So for me, we can break this down to different levels. There is definitely public information that everybody can benefit from. As we've been looking at AI and ML and all of those sort of things, I work for Disney. We were very early on with Google on character recognition, facial recognition. Makes our life a lot easier. And everybody can benefit from Mickey Mouse being automatically identified in a picture. So that sort of thing is great. But once we really start looking at things that impact the way the business works and the way the business thinks, we don't want that sort of learning getting out and benefiting our competitors. So that's where we want the IP of that to stay with us, I guess. And then, you touched on it. We need to make sure our data, even in models where we might share the learning, we still want our data to be protected. So we want that isolated, and we don't want that all being fed back into a system that everybody has access to. So there's data segregation, there's IP protection as well, and then that there is that very public stuff that everybody can benefit from, and we all want to contribute towards.
Thanks, Gary. This has been super helpful. And thanks for sharing your perspective. I think it's very important for companies to really dumb things down to a level where they start worrying about the fundamentals before building an array of enterprise-grade security tools that will perhaps not make them any more secure than where they got started in the first place. And I think that's a very important message. Thanks for sharing experiences. And to the viewers, thanks for attending yet another episode. We'll see you soon.
Thank you so much.